Hi, I'm Madhvi Romani.
And I'm Rina Grobe.
And this is Misinformed, the podcast that keeps you aware of feminist news and culture the easy way.
So, Madhvi, what are we talking about today?
So this week, I've been thinking about men's sexual anxieties and fantasies and war and how they're all related. There are a lot of wars going on right now. The amount of sexual violence is part of war as we know it. And all over the world, women's bodies are the front lines of war. Despite what people might think about war, it's always women's bodies that are the battlegrounds of war. There were two particular things that I wanted to discuss. One was the New York Times article, which was published on December the 28th, called Screams Without Words, and focused on how sexual violence was a systemic weapon used by Hamas during the October 7th attack. And that was, first of all, reported and published by a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist called Gettleman. And then those journalists rely on stringers and other researchers and stuff. And they relied on one particular person who was really, really problematic. Her name is Anat Schwartz, an Israeli filmmaker and former Air Force intelligence official, and had never, ever reported before. Somehow ended up reporting for the biggest, most influential newspaper in the world. And they landed a front page story. And from the get-go, the story that was defined that they should do from the New York Times editors, so it wasn't really her idea, was that they wanted to investigate sexual violence from Hamas. So this was already a man's idea, white men's idea of a story framing. And then her job was to go out and verify through, as you do, forensic evidence, visual evidence, eyewitness accounts. They got no forensic evidence, no eyewitness accounts. At some point, she even said in a podcast herself, in a podcast which was in Hebrew, she said that she started to doubt, like, oh, am I looking for sexual violence and not finding anything anywhere? Is it me? Because she went to all the hospitals. She asked the police for forensic evidence. They finally found some eyewitness accounts, but they were super shady, discredited people who kept on changing their stories. There were people who belonged to certain groups, like, you know, the Israeli military, or were blatantly doing propaganda for the international press, and they were lying. The police started lying. I mean, it was so discredited, and this ran on the front page of the New York Times, and therefore at a turning point in the war where people were like, this is totally inhumane what's happening in Gaza, the front page of the New York Times just propelled the war even further. And this story, which is, I would argue, a male fantasy about justifying war because of sexual violence by inhuman animal Arab men or whatever, it ended up riling up more support for the war and killing a lot of Palestinian women and children. So if we're talking about feminism and sexual violence here, what's happened is basically that sexual violence is being, and feminism is being, weaponized. Like Netanyahu himself was talking about, there's a culture of silence around this and stuff, because there were no eyewitness, I mean, no women were saying that they were sexually assaulted, but they were using this like feminism and sexual violence thing, along with Sheryl Sandberg and the original journalist. They ended up on a panel at Columbia University, you know, to put a face on like feminism and what work they were doing in support of women's rights, and, you know, to bring to light sexual violence, which never happened. Even the front page of the New York Times, the picture that they used was of a woman who had been murdered in the October the 7th attack, and her body was charred. Even her relative said that she was not raped. Like, they got a text from her at 6:51 saying stuff was going off, and by 7 o'clock her husband confirmed that she was dead. So they're like, how in like 9 minutes was she supposed to have been repeatedly raped and sexually assaulted in this area, in this music festival, which is a wide open space, which is a war setting, like in exactly this context, it just made no sense at all, even though, of course, like I said, sexual violence is a weapon of war. So the New York Times failed massively. And if you want to read about it, you can read about the entire reporting process from her own words, from Anat Schwartz's own words, how she couldn't find any evidence time after time after time from October to December, and they still published. And afterwards, the New York Times spokesman reeled it back, saying, oh, there may have been some, you know, sexual assaults or something. And the front page headline was systematic use of sexual violence. I want to sort of talk about that and also just the language of war and how it relates to feminism.
Absolutely. I mean, the New York Times, I think, has been incredibly disappointing because time and time again, they've sort of shown where their priorities lie. I remember when the article came out and I found it incredibly difficult, not necessarily the article itself, but it put women and all survivors in a really, really difficult position, didn't it? Because on the one hand, you know, you have the situation where people already think women lie about rape. There is this myth in society that people think that women make up the myth that they were raped for, but I don't even know what they think women are trying to get out of it. Ruin someone's reputation, fame, prestige. I have no idea what in their sick, twisted mind they think women are going to achieve by making up this lie. And then on the other hand, you also have that women aren't believed and that women are the most vulnerable in the population, along with children, and in these situations are the victim of war. So what the New York Times has done is so irresponsible, not just to the people of Gaza and to journalism and integrity, but also to all survivors in the world.
And the women themselves, the Israeli women who were interviewed in all of those hospitals, they said no. They said they were not sexually assaulted. But because it served the story that the toxic masculinity wanted to use, then they were not believed again when they said no. They were not sexually assaulted.
So rape has just become a further weapon of men, but now it's the imaginary sick fantasies that men have come up with. But when I originally saw the headline and read the article, I was so torn because obviously my first instinct always is to be well, I believe these women, right? When you read that headline as a woman, your first instinct should be, yes, if these women say this happened, this happened. And then as it fell apart and was discredited, I'm like, great. This ramification, now men all over the world are going to be well, if it was in the, front page of the New York Times and it was fake, well, then, all these other allegations, they are also fake. And I'm like, God damn it.
But if you look at the article, most of the people who are saying, they're saying, oh, well, those women who were raped, they mostly were killed afterwards. So they didn't have those statements at all. And then it was people who, it was men, it was the police officers, it was a man who was standing in the bush saying he saw a woman get raped, by five men. And the funny thing is, he said even the main story of that woman, the lead image and the lead person whose family disputes that she was raped at all, the eyewitness account said that five men who are not part of Hamas, they were just Palestinian, they raped her. So then that doesn't even justify the newspaper's big claim that Hamas is using sexual violence, because the eyewitness themselves, the Israeli guy, who was super unreliable anyway, who was in a bush with five other people who they didn't see it because they were looking in different directions. They didn't see a woman being raped by five men. It was his story, most of it was based on, and he's super unreliable. So it was the stories of men that were mostly, and there was I think there was one woman, none of her claims were corroborated. And that's why Netanyahu was going a bit nuts, because he was going against feminists and saying, well, the feminists have a culture of silence. And even the journalist who was trying to make this story happen was saying there's this culture of silence around sexual violence, but there was just no evidence. Therefore, there was silence.
Also just what a misguided view of the situation, because there is no culture of silence among feminists about rape. If anything, the culture of silence, which whatever that means in this context, is men not believing women, rapists not being persecuted, men victim blaming. You're this is a really weird sort of world that they have created, in which they're further weaponizing sexual assault. And what's really interesting is that rape as a weapon of war in 1998, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which was established by the United Nations, made this landmark decision that rape with the intent to affect a population or culture as a whole is a form of genocide. And so I can kind of see how they were trying to weaponize this idea, right? Because there's this whole sort of thing where Israel in this situation is painting itself as a victim, which, like, just to be clear, on October 7th, it was a victim. And so they're trying to repurpose this idea of rape to fit their narrative, when in reality, it's the person, or not exactly the people, but like the population of people they're accusing of this who are at the receiving end right now.
And also, that's the other question of, if you have a newspaper that's done this massive investigation from October to December with all their resources and the editors all working on this and pushing this story and making it front page, where is the other side? Like I said, in all wars, on all sides, because war is essentially a culmination of toxic masculinity. So it's against all women. Where is the stuff on the other side saying about Palestinians being raped, which I'm sure they are, and the Palestinian women being sexually assaulted by Israeli soldiers and settlers and everything? And just also, I just wanted to talk about Sheryl Sandberg. Like, she has gone from already an absolute, I just want to say dickhead, because that's what she is. She's an absolute dickhead to the biggest moron ever. By this point, she's anti-feminist. So this is from the Intercept article. In early December, Israeli officials launched an intensive public campaign accusing the international community and specifically feminist leaders of standing silence in the face of widespread systematic sexual violence of Hamas's October 7th attack. Which there wasn't any in that particular attack. The PR effort was rolled out at the United Nations on December the 4th with an event hosted by the Israeli ambassador and former Meta executive Sheryl Sandberg. The feminist organisations that were targeted by pro-Israel figures were caught flat-footed, as charges of sexual violence had not yet circulated widely. And Sandberg was quoted attacking women's rights organizations in a December the 4th New York Times article headlined "What We Know About Sexual Violence During October 7th Attacks on Israel," and whose publication coincided with the launch of the PR campaign at the UN. So this is all, by this point, this is totally like propaganda. And the article that was published that Sandberg was quoted in and was also reported by Gettelman, Schwartz and Seller, those three same people who did the December article, relied on claims made by Israeli officials and acknowledged that the Times had not been able to corroborate the allegations.
Great job, Sheryl.
Also, great job, New York Times. Sorry, well, how do they publish things that are not corroborated? And then Israel promised that it had extraordinary amounts of eyewitness testimony, because the police said that they were not relying on autopsies or forensic evidence, so none of the normal stuff. And then they said that investigators have gathered tens of thousands of testimonies of sexual violence committed by Hamas on October the 7th, according to Israeli police, right? At the site of the music festival. However, those testimonies have never materialized. Tens of thousands.
It's absolutely ridiculous. And Sheryl Sandberg's second guest appearance on our podcast, I think we talked about her last time, and I think she is just further proof that not all women are feminists and not all women who claim to be feminists actually are. So great job, Sheryl.
She's awful. And also, why is she become, because of this is the face of feminism. She's the one that they talk to. Somebody who, what? Her. Why her?
Yeah. There are so many better people to talk to.
Infuriating.
It's also just super infuriating, because I'm 100% sure there are Israeli women, like, outside of the October 7th attacks, who have been sexually assaulted and raped. And like, this also further like lays doubt upon their claims, you know? So it's like, regardless of what woman, where, on what side of ever, this is just shit for them, for Israeli women, for Palestinian women. At the end of the day, again, women get the shit end of the stick.
And then I wanted to talk about also the whole thing about war and male sexual fantasy. So I read this, apparently it's a seminal essay. It's called Sex and Death in the Rational World of Defense Intellectuals. It was written by Carol Cohn in 1985. She started looking into what's called nuclear strategic thinking, because, you know, that was big in the 80s during this like nuclear arms race. The role of specialized language that she calls techno-strategic, and how this language helps the machinery and the business of war continue and be justified. And what's really interesting, what is wild and crazy actually, is like she starts documenting like all of the language used, and it's all sexual language in its toxic masculinity and the language of, you know, rape culture and sexual domination and homoeroticism and cold, rational, you know, non-emotional things, like this strategic, very cold, very non-body linked language that she says is used in all of these circles. So I just wanted to say some of the stuff that she noticed. This is in 1985, but there was a new article and it shows that things haven't really changed. So first of all, she says the language of defense intellectuals is bizarre because it's a world where men spend their days calmly and matter-of-factly discussing nuclear weapons, nuclear strategy, and nuclear war. They remove all the sense of like horror, urgency, moral outrage from what they're talking about. So for example, she takes the idea of like clean bombs. Clean bombs are nuclear devices that they rely on fusion rather than fission, and so then they release energy, not radiation, so it's still got the same destructive explosive power. But by calling it a clean bomb, they sort of take out all of the emotional fallout. So she's like, anyone who's seen pictures of Hiroshima and all the burnt bodies and the screaming children and all this sort of stuff, like it's got nothing to do related with that. And then the other thing she talks about is how like feminists have often said that an important aspect of the arms race is this like phallic worship or missile envy. And she said that this, like, she always found this uncomfortably reductionist, but then she started researching it and she was like not prepared for what she had found, because she thought that she could go in undercover and maybe catch a few men talking about, you know, things that they wouldn't say in front of women. But she was totally wrong. She was like, they're just really, really open about it. They talk about, for example, nuclear weapons as being irresistible because you get more bang for your buck. That one military advisor to the National Security Council said something like, releasing 70 to 80% of our mega tonnage in one orgasmic womp. There was serious concern about the need to harden our missiles. And they were saying, oh, let's face it, the Russians are a little harder than we are. And she was saying, like, disbelieving glances would occasionally pass between me and my one ally, so like one other woman in the summer program, and nobody else seemed to notice this stuff. Yeah, even she looks at like magazines, and for example, from a June 1985 issue of Air Force magazine, across the top of a two-page advertisement for the AV-8B Harrier 2, the words that emblazoned across the top of this missile is, speak softly and carry a big stick. And then she describes a time when they go to like a submarine and everyone can put their like hand through this like hole and then like pat the missile. And she's just like, what is all this patting? What are men doing when they pat these high-tech phalluses? Like,
wait, I'm sorry. Is this like a glory hole, but for missiles?
Yes, exactly. And she says, like, patting is an assertion of intimacy, sexual possession, and affectionate domination. The thrill and pleasure of patting the missile is the proximity of all that phallic power and the possibly of vicariously appropriating it as one's own. So she's really actually, like, just shocked about it. So she goes through all the different categories of words that are used. So for example, virginity, fathers, sons, domestic bliss, male birth and creation, which is a really good one because, you know, like Oppenheimer's baby and all of this sort of stuff, like male birth. Ernst Lawrence telegram to physicists in Chicago in 1942 read, congratulations to the new parents, can hardly wait to see the new arrival. This is how they talk about weapons of mass destruction. And you would think that it would have changed, actually. You know, so she wrote this in 1985, so we're a good 40 years onwards. But I read another article that was written just in at the end of 2023 by Nico Edwards, who is a PhD candidate in international relations at the University of Sussex, and she's researching militarism and ecological injustice. So she's basically looking at this like greenification of military weapons and stuff. And she went to DSEI, which happens in London biannually, and it's one of the most important weapons warfare things. And green warfare is apparently a thing, which doesn't make any sense, but whatever. And she says it's all white men in suits, and they're all like bonding over this like sexual imagery again. And as a Swedish blonde woman, she got a lot of like totally weird interactions.
I can tell you what green warfare is. Green warfare is the German foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, running on a platform of saying that she's going to stop exporting arms. But then once she is in office as a member of the Green Party, she has increased arms sales. And that is what green warfare is. I just wanted to ask quickly, did you go see the movie Oppenheimer?
No.
Did you know that that movie grossed nearly $1 billion worldwide?
No.
It is a 3-hour long circle jerk where men basically are just congratulating themselves on how amazing this atomic bomb is and how important and amazing and spiritual it is. And like, it was super interesting to watch because you have all these men, right? I mean, they're actors, but they're all living together and they're all acting like the thing they're doing is the world's most important thing. And there's this sense of urgency and importance. And it's interesting because when I saw the movie, obviously it came out a while ago, I didn't know all this information, you know, about how they speak about bombs and sort of language. But you can kind of like looking back now, you can kind of see that reflected because there is an intimacy there and the way the men deal with each other in a weird intimacy that you don't really ever see men deal with each other with, you know?
It's just really interesting because Carol Kahn, she names spirituality as one of the main clusters of words and concepts that are used around the language of war by men. Kahn says, perhaps the most astonishing of all is the fact that the creators of strategic doctrine actually refer to members of their community as the nuclear priesthood. It's hard to decide what is most extraordinary about this. The easy arrogance of their claim to the virtues and supernatural power of priesthood, or the tacit admission, never spoken directly, that rather than being unflinching, hard-nosed, objective, empirically minded, scientific describers of reality, they are really creators of dogma, or the extraordinary implicit statement about who, or rather what, has become God. If this new priesthood attains its status through the inspired knowledge of nuclear weapons, it gives a whole new meaning to the phrase, a mighty fortress of our God. Yeah, it's really interesting because this woman who went to do her research at the Defense and Security Equipment International Fair, basically, which is really interesting, even defense and security, right? It's not called destruction and horror, is it? And before, the Verteidigungsministerium in Germany used to be called, Verteidigung means defense. So the defense ministry in Germany used to be called just the Department of Krieg, like war, the war department, which is far more honest. But now you get all these cold words like defense and security, like what are they defending and what is security? Like it sounds so nice. But she was saying in her article or her blog post, actually, which is called Sex, Power and Play at Europe's Largest Arm Fair. We'll link to it in our newsletter. What's really interesting is she was saying that like attending DSEI as a female body made her aware of just how palpable a socializing force sexism remains in 2023. And how it's reached a climax in the world of war. So like all these men, you know, the socialization, you know, they're coming together to either impress women or compete with women or dominate or like, you know, in this just this absolute toxic masculinity. And she said that she became a literal bodily inscription of unhinged entitlement among white men belonging to the 1%. But also what's really interesting She says that the violent consequences of this and the norms it sustains are far from affecting only women. They are also the norms that force men into inhumane roles of sexual predators, soldiers, and martyrs, that mold men into dutiful patriots, that demand that they relinquish their right to life free from the use and reception of violence, sacrificing their sense of humanity, their vulnerability and emotional sensitivity, and their access to intimacy beyond sexual domination. And then she makes the best point ever, which is like, yet the fact remains that most of the men attending the DSEI are not those suffering the real life consequences of their trade, nor toxic masculinity. So basically, their entitlements wreak havoc across the entire world. And of course, mostly it's women and the poorest people and the dispossessed people that suffer.
What is that movie called? I like very vaguely remember this movie called like War Games or something. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like from like the 90s or the 80s. I don't remember. Where he like thinks he's playing a game, but it's like real.
Yeah. And then it ends up being a game in the end, I think. But he thinks, yeah, it starts becoming real. It's called War Games. And it's really interesting that it came out of that time because it was a good metaphor.
Yeah.
For what was happening. They were just playing these games. It could have just destroyed the world. Like, that was the situation that the entire world was in. And people still think that men make better leaders and the system we have is fine. We could have destroyed everything in the 80s, you know? That was a really good movie, actually.
Yeah, it's with Matthew Broderick. I vaguely remember it. But one of the things that I was just, you know, when you were talking about the military and all these things, one of the things that kind of ties all of this together nicely, or maybe not nicely, rather unnicely, I guess, is that actually, you know, sexual assault also runs rampant in the military.
Yes. And domestic abuse.
Yeah. Yes. And I've been like trying to find some statistics and there's so many different ones out there. But here's in a 2012 Pentagon survey found that approximately 26,000 women and men were sexually assaulted that year. And that of those, only 3,000 cases were reported. And that, for example, in the United States Air Force, 1 in 5 women who were sexually assaulted by service members reported. The layers of sexual depravity, of the way that sexual violence is sort of entrenched within this sort of form of violence, is so off the charts. And just really looping it back to what our conversation was at the beginning, one of the things that sort of has like completely driven me crazy about this whole situation, other than, of course, like using rape to further your gain is horrible and disgusting, and it's horrible and disgusting for all women, regardless of where they're from, is the fact that there are credible accusations of sexual violence by Israeli soldiers against Palestinian women and children. And the UN panel has confirmed that these allegations are credible. So shouldn't that be the top story? Like, the way that so much attention is given to one story and one group of women receive sympathy and attention, regardless of whether or not the story is true, and another group of women are sort of swept under the rug as just sort of like collateral damage of war, that's just what happens, is incredibly mind-boggling to me and just further aggravates the it makes me mad in a way that I really cannot articulate.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Also, this hierarchy of women, Sheryl Sandberg, my God. But also like women in the West, for example, us in Germany, we're one of the biggest exporters of arms. Our country and our wealth and everything is built on the backs of women suffering under war. And Denmark is the biggest exporter of arms to Israel. And therefore is responsible for the absolute subjugation of women in Palestine, whereas women in Denmark have, you know, the most amount of equality and rights. And like, yeah, where is our solidarity, you know?
Yes, absolutely. And it becomes even more mind-boggling when you realize the Women, Peace and Security Index, the WPS, found that Denmark is the best place to live as a woman. You just, you know, overall can have the best quality of life if you're a woman in Denmark. And then they're making life hell for poor women. Other, like, it's just the irony, not even irony, the hypocrisy of the situation is so infuriating. To be like, oh yeah, we're so great to women. Also, by the way, we're enabling this war, genocide, rape, and all these other horrible things. But now don't look at that. Look at us. Look how great we are. All the freaking Scandinavian countries, they're all like this. You know, they always talk about how, like, oh, it's so great to be a woman in any of the Scandinavian countries. It's like, yeah, but with the caveat, if you are a white Scandinavian woman, if you're a refugee, if you are an immigrant, if you are a woman of color, no, not so much.
That was what was really interesting about the woman who wrote this article about going to this arms fair. Her name's Nico Edwards, and she actually acknowledges this because she's a Swedish blonde woman, and she said it was referred to and fetishized so much that she can't even imagine what it would be like to be a black woman body or trans body or a disabled body in this space at all. She can't imagine it because she was like, it's bad enough for even a Scandinavian woman doing a PhD in this area, and it just becomes so apparent how hard other women have it.
And I think it's not acknowledged and it's not talked about. And it's really, truly disgusting that women's suffering and the pain of women is further being weaponized to further different agendas. And it's really sad that at the end, you know, at the end of all of this, when all of this is said and done or whatever has come of it, you know, women are always going to have to bear all of the negative consequences, whether they are the women in Palestine or, you know, they are the women elsewhere in the world who have been sexually assaulted, who are not believed. We bear the brunt of it always, and that's horrifying. Here are three things you can do this week to be a better person. Thing one, there are some really cool initiatives right now based in Cairo, Egypt, which are helping people who have crossed over the border to sort of helping them with supplies, with apartments, with food, with anything they may need to sort of get back up on their feet. It's a grassroots organization. The author Aya Moro, who is an amazing Egyptian-British writer, she has actually traveled to Cairo to sort of be on the ground to help set that up. We can link all of it in our newsletter. It's a really great way, direct way to have an impact and to help people immediately.
Thing two, can we please, please, please cancel Sheryl Sandberg? I don't know how to get rid of this woman, but I don't know how we do it. Can we just get rid of her? And I don't even care. I know how that sounds. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Thing three is really always be aware. I know that this entire episode and this New York Times article maybe hasn't been the best example, but really be aware of women generally do not lie about being raped. And it's really important that we believe survivors and we believe people when they say they have been raped.
For all links to sources and further reading for this week's episode, subscribe to our newsletter, misinformed.substack.com.
Email us if you'd like to come on the show or join our book club, misinformed.podcast@gmail.com.
Follow us on Instagram at @the_miss_informed.
And support the show via Patreon by going to patreon.com/misinformed.